Hello, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, Chief Medical Officer of the American Lung Association. Welcome to Lungcast. As the recognized Asthma Awareness Month, May is an ideal time to return to the subject of the most common respiratory disease in the United States. A condition similar to asthma had been described as far back as 2600 BC in China and ancient Egypt. The description included breathlessness and respiratory distress, but asthma did not acquire its name or unique characteristics until Hippocrates described it over 2,000 years later in Greece. Hippocrates, a figure people often label as the grandfather of modern medicine, was the first person on record to link asthma symptoms to environmental triggers and specific activities, such as trades and professions, such as metalwork. Hippocrates only saw asthma as a symptom. It was not until the year 100 that a Greek physician called Aretaeus of Cappadocia composed a detailed definition of asthma that was similar to the modern understanding of how the disease develops. He suggested a remedy of drinking a concoction of owl's blood and wine. However, thankfully, no longer it is recommended as an intervention for asthma. Later in 1892, Sir William Osler, one of the co-founders of the Johns Hopkins Medical School, set out his own definition of asthma. Bronchial spasms featured high on his list, and he noted the similarities between asthma and allergic conditions such as hay fever, as well as asthma's tendency to run in families and start in childhood. He also identified specific triggers of asthma, such as climate, extreme emotion, and diet. However, his focus on airway blockage as the result of smooth muscle spasms in the airways meant that doctors and pharmacies began to distribute medications called bronchodilators to calm the airway spasms in people with asthma. It was not until the latter half of the 20th century when the role of inflammation as a key driver in asthma was recognized. During this past year alone, Lungcast has reviewed a multitude of matters surrounding modern asthma care, from the emerging research of pathway targeting agents to updated management guidelines and considerations to be made toward pediatric cases. Today's conversation features an amalgamation of these asthma topics and even more with a pair of highly qualified experts. Dr. Elliot Israel, a professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School in the Division of Pulmonary Critical Care and Allergy and Immunology, as well as a clinician at Brigham and Women's Hospital, joins us, as does Dr. Juan Carlos Carday, an assistant professor in the Department of Internal Medicine within the Division of Allergy and Immunology at the University of South Florida, Morsani College of Medicine. Their discussion will include guideline-supported SMART strategy, the role of COVID in current asthma risks, and their own research in the disparate medical and financial impacts of asthma on the U.S. population. We hope you enjoy this encompassing interview on the field of asthma.
I wanted to level set the issue which we are discussing today by quoting from the first paragraph of your recent article in the February 26th issue of the New England Journal of Medicine. In the United States, asthma results in considerable illness, including more than 3,300 asthma-attributed deaths in adults each year. Annual costs for asthma in adults total more than $67 billion and are substantially higher in patients with uncontrolled asthma than in those with controlled asthma. And this last sentence is key. Owing to a complex array of factors, Black and Latinx populations bear disproportionate asthma morbidity and mortality. During an earlier Lungcast episode, we heard from Dr. Ann Dixon from the University of Vermont, who reviewed the focused updates to the NHLBI asthma guidelines in 2020. Significant among those was the SMART strategy. So to begin with, I was hoping if one of you would please review the SMART strategy and the rationale behind now being recommended, because I know it had been recommended in Europe for several years.
Sure, I can do that. So SMART stands for Single Maintenance and Reliever Therapy. The rationale for doing that, and that's usually in the form of single inhaler that includes two therapies. One is an inhaled corticosteroid component, and then the other one is formoterol, which is a beta agonist bronchodilator that is it's long lasting, but it's also quick onset. So the rationale for that There's many of them. One is that we know that excessive use of only reliever therapy associates with excessive asthma morbidity. We also know that underuse of controller therapy for asthma associates with excessive asthma morbidity. And we know that patients in general, they adherence decreases if asthma controller therapy regimens becomes too complicated. They have too many inhalers. That's too much of a complication that reduces adherence. So in trying to simplify an asthma controller therapy, you might as well have everything in one. One inhaler to use as reliever therapy and one inhaler to use also as controller therapy.
As with many things in medicine, adoption of new thoughts and practices can be slow, even when they're made part of accepted guidelines. Do you get the sense that SMART is being implemented among your colleagues?
SMART makes a lot of sense. It works in terms of the way the patients may want to use their medications. For more moderate and severe patients, remember, as Juan Carlos pointed out, it's simultaneous or maintenance and reliever therapy. So using their inhaler, their inhaled corticosteroid for Motrol twice a day and as needed. And while one would think that that would be easy to adopt, it's actually turning out not to be as easy as one would think. And there are several reasons for this. Some of them relate to things in the United States, and some of them actually relate to maybe the way SMART was studied. One of the issues with SMART is that, first of all, it involves in patients who are on a regimen that doesn't include the inhaled corticosteroid and formoterol, involves changing their therapy. So having to revamp their therapy. A lot of patients are fairly comfortable with what they're doing, and so re-educating them is not as easy as one might think. The other important piece is that SMART was really to a lot of our astonishment, was only tested in patients who were on a inhaler used through a metered dose inhaler. All the SMART studies that show the effectiveness of SMART in moderate to severe asthmatics excluded patients who used nebulizers. And whether we like it or not, in the United States, and actually to some extent even in Europe, patients, especially moderate to severe asthmatics, are using a lot of nebulizers for their reliever therapy. And there are multiple causes for that. Actually, as a result of the PREPARE study, we published another study looking at interviewing patients about why they use inhaler nebulizer therapy. And they feel that it's more effective for them. In many cases, believe it or not, they think it's more convenient. And they feel that it works where their meter dose inhaler doesn't. When one looks at prescriptions for moderate severe asthmatics, and in our study, more than half the patients were using nebulizer therapy as their reliever therapy. And SMART relies on not using your nebulizer, because the way SMART works and why we think it works is because when patients start using their reliever therapy more, they're getting more inhaled corticosteroid, because that's a necessity if that's what you're using with a meter dose inhaler. But if you're not using the meter dose inhaler, instead you're using the nebulizer, you're not getting the benefit of the SMART therapy. So that's another piece of this, which I think many of us didn't realize in terms of the implementation of SMART with so many of our patients using nebulizer. A third problem for us in the United States in terms of implementation of SMART is that there is a specific wording in the FDA IND and the FDA actually wording for inhaled corticosteroid for Motrol that says it should not be used as reliever therapy. So many insurance companies are not willing to pay for an extra canister to be written as needed therapy, because they say that is against the FDA guidance on how these medications should be used. And many prescribers are reluctant to prescribe because that's what the FDA guidance says. And unfortunately, in order to, as we understand it, the FDA wording on the medication will not be changed unless there's another study done. And our understanding is that such a study will not be undertaken. So there are barriers to using SMART. It's clearly very effective, for a certain population of patients, but it turns out that it's not as easy to implement, and it probably may be more limited in terms of its effectiveness for a large variety of patients.
Important point. I wondered whether formularies and rules around the prescribing played a role, so important aspect. So I wanted to shift gears a little bit. Given the comments earlier from your article regarding the Black and Latinx population, please discuss the motivation and your planning for the study, the PREPARE trial, and the results that you obtained.
Sure. So as you mentioned in the introduction, there has been for a very long time a significant excess morbidity for Black and Hispanic populations with asthma. They suffer death at twice the rates almost as Caucasian population or white populations. The rates of hospitalizations are much higher. And these rates and these discrepancies have been very difficult to reduce. There have been multiple studies that have looked at ways to try to reduce this. Many interventions have not been effective. The interventions that look like they're effective usually are very labor intensive and thus are resource intensive and are unlikely to be adopted because of the resources they end up needing to try to do this. And so as we studied and thought about this discrepancy, we actually involved patients and I asked patients about what the different types of problems they were encountering in terms of controlling their asthma and how they would approach them. And so several of the things came out. One of the things was that exacerbations were a significant impairment for patients. Patients felt that, especially for these moderate and severe patients, that they were having a hard time in terms of their quality of life because of exacerbations. They were having hard times keeping jobs, staying in school, keeping up with their kids when they were having these exacerbations. People would lose their jobs because they'd have to be out because of these exacerbations. The other thing that we also heard from patients is that they wanted to be in control. And so one of the things that we had previously shown through the NIH-supported Asthma Clinical Research Network and in data that we had published in the New England Journal was that you could use as-needed medications a la the SMART approach, and that might actually benefit patients even on top of what they were doing. And so what we ended up coming up with was saying, okay, we're hearing that patients want to be in control, that they would like to be able to feel that they have some presence in terms of control of their asthma. Why don't we see whether giving them an inhaled corticosteroid inhaler and saying, okay, every time you use your reliever, whether you're using your reliever as a meter dose inhaler or you're using your nebulizer, we want you to use this inhaled corticosteroid and we're not changing your underlying therapy. Mm. So you're in control. Whatever you've been taking before is what you're taking before. But we're giving you this strategy, which we believe, based on our prior investigations, has a good chance of decreasing morbidity and decreasing the effects of asthma for you. And so that's the way we approached it in collaboration with these patient partners. We actually designed this study where we did this and said, okay, we will have one group where we give them an inhaled corticosteroid inhaler on top of their therapy, take moderate to severe asthmatics, so patients who either have had an exacerbation in the past year or have poor control based on their asthma control test. And we were going to restrict this to Black or Hispanic Latinx patients because that's where the need was and the biggest bang for your buck in terms of potential benefit here. And we would also, thinking about this, wanted to put together an intervention that we thought would not only be something that patients would want to do, but we thought also would be easy on providers. So what we did is we designed a study where there was just one session of instruction where patients were told, here, we're giving you this inhaled corticosteroid inhaler. We're giving you a pouch to hold your meter dose inhaler and your inhaled corticosteroid. We're also giving you an inhaled corticosteroid inhaler to put by your neb, if you use a neb. And we want you to take, every time you use your meter dose inhaler, we want you to take the inhaled corticosteroid. Every time you use your nebulizer, we want you to take 5 puffs of the inhaled corticosteroid because we know that a MDI is about the equivalent of five puffs. A nebulizer is about the equivalent of five puffs of an MDI. So we figured we'd try to do like for like here. And we sent patients off and said, we will follow you for 15 months. We will send you a survey once a month where we ask you whether you've had an exacerbation. If you said you had an exacerbation, we'll verify that through your medical records. And that's it. And you can call an 800 number and get a refill of your inhaled corticosteroid when you need it. And that's the way we designed the study. We thought that it would be low impact in terms of resource use for providers, that it would be acceptable to patients. And we hoped that it would reduce exacerbations. And I should mention that we had obviously a control group who were patients who were educated in asthma. Well, both sets of patients watched a video about asthma and how to control your asthma. Both sets of patients got these pouches, but the control group did not get an extra inhaled corticosteroid. They weren't told to do that, and they weren't given an extra inhaled corticosteroid. But otherwise, they were used the same. They got the same calendar or reminders once a month to tell us about whether they had exacerbations. And then we looked at exacerbations. We looked at quality of life. We looked at asthma control tests, the asthma symptom utility index, and we looked at days lost from work and school while we were measuring the background use of inhaled corticosteroids. So what we found was a significant reduction in exacerbations when we compared the intervention group to the control group. The reduction in exacerbations was 0.12 exacerbations per patient per year in the compared to the control group. And you might think 0.12 exacerbations per patient per year is not a large difference. But Juan Carlos actually did a fair amount of research looking at all the studies that were done with SMART that we talked about before, and looking at all those studies in moderate to severe asthmatics, and then compiling the rate of difference that was seen between the intervention and the control groups in SMART. And remember, and actually, actually all the SMART studies, as I mentioned, excluded patients using a nebulizer. But in addition, all the SMART studies only included patients who had an exacerbation in the prior year. We were, again, to be a real-world study with ease of intervention. We did not restrict our patients to that. We allowed any clinical diagnosis of asthma. You did not have to have an exacerbation in the past year. You could. That was one of the ways you got in, but you could also get in by being poorly controlled.
Or a bronchodilator response as well.
Pardon me?
Many of the SMART studies also required patients to have a positive bronchodilator response.
Yes. All the ones with moderate severe asthma required that you bronchodilate. We did not require this at all. Some of them excluded smokers. We included smokers as well. So when Juan Carlos looked at this, the average change, and the NAPP, as you might recall, has changed its recommendation saying we should use SMART therapy for moderate to severe asthmatics. This was a new recommendation, the new NAPP update. The studies that were cited by the NAPP actually on average produced a 0.12 rate of improvement in exacerbations. We exceeded that. I think we were 0.13. So we actually produced the same degree of exacerbation reduction that caused the NAPP, the National Asthma Education Program, to change its recommendations and say you should use SMART therapy. Additionally, when we went back and restricted our analysis to just the patients who had an exacerbation, because remember, I told you all the SMART studies included only people with exacerbations, then we actually had almost twice the amount of reduction in exacerbations that SMART did. So this actually was a significant change. And we had no ability, as Juan Carlos just pointed out, we had no ability to restrict ourselves even further to people who bronchodilate, because we didn't test for that. This, again, we had no spirometry to get into the study. There was no spirometry during the study. It was just usual care. So that was another point. So we had a very significant outcome. In addition, we ended up improving the asthma control test by more than 3 points on average for patients. We also ended up improving the asthma symptom utility index, which is an improvement in terms of asthma quality of life, And we ended up reducing the days lost from work in school. And then the other kind of really important piece was, so you could ask yourself, because we said in the beginning, hey, interventions to reduce exacerbations in these populations have generally been very resource intensive. What did it, quote unquote, cost, if you will, to do this? It turned out that when you looked at the average use of controller medication in the intervention group versus the control group, the amount of extra inhaled corticosteroid canisters used on average was 1.1 canisters a year. So 1.1 canisters a year produced these effects. The interesting thing, again, Juan Carlos had looked at this, when you look at the studies that reported in SMART, how much extra SMART canisters were used, on average, it was 4 extra canisters for SMART. So the kind of nice thing about this is we ended up producing an effect that is at least as good and probably quite a bit better than SMART at a cost, if you will, that seems to be less than SMART and without the implementation problems that SMART has. So I think that we were excited about this result, as were our stakeholders and patient partners. And I don't know, Juan Carlos, if you want to add anything there.
I think you covered a lot of ground with that.
No, and it sounds like you had a really true real world setting and got around some of the hurdles of SMART strategy that we talked about earlier. And I guess the important thing with these results, and maybe I'll refer this to Dr. Carday, is what would be your recommendations to healthcare providers who can see this data and help them really adopt, I guess the mnemonic is patient activated reliever triggered inhaled corticosteroid, or PARTIKS, as part of their office-based or hospital system?
Well, I think what we're doing right now is and your platform is a great opportunity to disseminate the message. That's what we're doing right now. I think one thing that Elliot was mentioning before is that FDA caution against using ICS formoterol for rescue therapy. There is no such thing for using QVAR. So for example, if I cannot get SMART therapy in clinic, even if I wanted to, I often try. And I think it's the same story for my colleagues here at USF. If somebody say is on fluticasone salmeterol, and then I tried to prescribe budesonide formoterol, then the pharmaceutical, the insurance company will reject such a thing. So it cannot be, that prescription cannot go through. But let's say that same patient is on fluticasone salmeterol and I prescribe any additional inhaled corticosteroid inhaler, I will probably get that patient to have that inhaled corticosteroid inhaler. So at least that may, that's a, for me, that's a big piece, a big barrier preventing SMART therapy that I think we were able to overcome it with a PARTIC strategy that you were mentioning. We're putting in a grant to PCORI for an implementation grant to test the adoptability of PARTIC at a healthcare system level. But I think we have a phase 4 clinical trial result now published in the New England Journal of Medicine. As much as we can to get this message out and tell physicians, it's keep doing what you're doing for patients. Whatever it is that is working for your patients, you can keep doing that. But whatever it is that they're using for rescue therapy, be it albuterol, ipratropium, combination of them, be it in MDI or nebulizer form, prescribe them an inhaled corticosteroid. We use beclomethasone. That's what we administer to patients, to our participants. But we have no reason to think that this effect in PARTIX is going to be exclusive to beclomethasone. We think that it's the inhaled corticosteroid supplementation piece that is making the difference. So the more that we can get the message out and tell physicians, tell your patients, keep doing whatever it is they're doing for controller therapy. But whenever they use a rescue therapy, puff themselves with an inhaled corticosteroid.
Point well taken. And as you know, the American Lung Association, you know, asthma education for our patients and providers is really one of our strong points of our mission. And certainly implementing system change has been another big thing we've worked on with asthma. So certainly with this type of interview, we can amplify your message and we'll continue to do so.
Appreciate it.
So I did notice that your study started pre-COVID and then ran through much of the pandemic. We know that the underserved population, including the ones you studied, were impacted more by COVID. And there also were differing opinions over the last couple of years as to how the presence of asthma affected one's risks with regard to COVID severity. Can you please discuss your thoughts on this and how this may or may not have affected your particular study?
Well, I think several of our co-investigators tried to address that very issue. Jennifer Carroll is a professor of research at the University of Colorado. She's one of the PREPARE co-investigators, and she led this effort where a subset of our participants were still in the study during COVID. They were administered a survey, and we found that you're asking about the impact of COVID on our participants. And as you can imagine, their ability, a sizable, substantial proportion of our participants face difficulties paying their bills, issues with employment, issues with their ability to get their medications. So all of this has an effect. That being said, an analysis done by Justin Salcioli, he's a pulmonary fellow and works with Elliot at Brigham and Women's Hospital. They did an analysis looking at our cohort before and after COVID. And we documented about a 50% reduction in asthma exacerbations rates that were robust adjustment to any changes in pollution. So this was especially noticeable among patients who worked outside the home. So despite this reduction in the main outcome that, you know, this asthma exacerbation rates was the primary outcome of the study. Despite that reduction in the event rate that we saw with COVID, our results were robust to that. We adjusted our results by the time of COVID.
So I know we've touched on this a little bit, but I'd like either of you to give further thoughts on really how do we keep addressing this disparity issue that in a lot of diseases, but particularly in asthma that we talk about. Just give your thoughts on what else we can do, both as physicians, and certainly the Lung Association will help amplify that as well.
I think a multi-pronged approach needs to happen for that. I think, as Elio was mentioning before, many interventions have been tested over time with very little efforts. But I think having a consciousness, there are structural issues in our system, I think, that create some of these disparities. So as individual clinicians, having an awareness of those issues and trying to keep it in the back of your head that, you know, efforts need to be taken for this person sitting across from me in clinic to try to reduce the burden from asthma, that's important. I think also having policy-wide changes are important to reduce some of those issues.
You know, and I think one of the things that we also learned from this is how important it is to really involve patients in the solution. Mm. That imposing things from above, while they're well-intentioned, may not really get at the problem. So for instance, you know, one of the whole issue of nebulizers was one that was brought to our attention by stakeholders and patients. We said, well, but what about when I'm not using my meter dose inhaler? And we said, oh, that's right. And the other pieces, for instance, we learned that a lot of people use meter dose inhalers because the copay for meter dose inhalers in many Medicaid programs is much, much less than it is for, I'm sorry, use nebulizers rather. The copay for nebulizers is much less than it is for metered dose inhalers. So again, needing to really approach people and understand how, what their lived experience is and how that can influence what you think might work is really, really important. And so I think the collaboration with the patients with asthma, I think, was really an important piece here in terms of getting to an effective solution. And I think that needs to be thought about on a, you know, an implementation level, both in the physician's office, as Juan Carlos is pointing out, at the system level and at the policy level, right? Because there are things that the policies do that we have unintended consequences and are important. And that gets to these structural problems, which can aggravate or amplify these disparities.
Well, again, I want to thank you both for your time today. This is an important message, especially with Asthma Awareness Month coming up. We will amplify your message. I want to thank you for what you're doing for the patients and keep up the good work. Have a good
rest. Thank you, and thank the American Lung Association for its good work.
You're welcome.
Thanks again to Drs. Israel and Carday for their time and their perspective. If you feel like learning more about the evolving field of asthma care, especially during this month of awareness, check out our past episodes with Dr. Ann Dixon on the latest management guidelines and with Dr. Mario Castro on the burgeoning field of biologics. For additional news and insights into respiratory health, be sure to visit us at hcplive.com and lung.org. Until next month, I'm Dr. Albert Rizzo, reminding you that if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. So just take it one breath at a time.